You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the days following the election of Donald Trump, women's marches were held in cities across the country to protest the new administration, but American women were by no means united in their response. 53% of white women had voted for Mr. Trump, while 94% of black women had voted for Hillary Clinton. In Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America, a new essay collection co-edited by Samhita Mukhopadhyay, a diverse group of writers reflect on the 2016 election and whether it's possible for women to unite and move forward. Joining us now to discuss the essays are Ms. Mukhopadhyay, along with contributor Sarah Jaffe, an independent journalist and Nation Institute fellow, and Collier Meyerson, a contributor to The Nation. Nasty Women is published by Picador, and I'm very pleased that it has brought them all to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Samhita, you write that the 2016 election wasn't just a loss for Clinton. It was a loss for feminism. How so?
Yeah. I think one of the things we saw in the election, not just, you know, whatever kind of criticisms people had of Clinton, an inability to really pull out the role that gender played in kind of her treatment and how people felt about her outside of her politics, but also the fact that she lost to someone. So you have this kind of historic first woman candidate, but she actually lost to someone who was so openly misogynistic and someone who, you know, was caught on the record talking about, you know, non-consensual acts towards women, sexual acts towards women, and that was not a deal breaker for Americans. That was kind of like, it is what it is. And I think that was, for many women, a wake-up call around how people view women and their kind of role in public space and public policies.
The title of the collection, Nasty Women, refers to an insult that candidate Trump threw at Hillary Clinton during the debate. Why do you think the phrase was picked up and commodified almost immediately after he said it? I've seen a lot of women walking around with Nasty Woman t-shirts.
Yeah. I think it's fun. I think people, you know, you take it as a sense of pride to be a woman that calls men out and to be called nasty, as opposed to what women are expected to be, which is polite and, kind of follow the rules. But I also, you know, Collier wrote in her essay how that did become commodified. So, you know, I'm sure she has some thoughts on this, too.
Some of the essays in this collection are critical and based on news and economics and such. Others are just offer a more personal perspective. What's the focus that brings them all together? What do you think, Sarah?
Oh, goodness. I think the focus that brings everything together in this essay is what's bringing together a lot of disparate political positions right now, as people realize that things are bad, things are not getting worse. And especially after this election, I think a lot of people who either voted for Hillary Clinton or are to her left realize that no election is going to fix that for us either. And so whether you're grappling with sort of the feelings of loss because Hillary Clinton didn't win, or whether you're grappling with the sheer horror that Trump's election has unleashed for a lot of people, you're dealing with the fact that we have to do something besides vote.
Of course, there are a lot of people, Collier, who think that this election was great and continue to think that the president is doing a great job.
Yeah.
I'm sure. You're nodding your head.
Those people do exist. An ever-shrinking number of them, though.
Yes, that's true.
Samhita, you begin your introductory essay, "I'm a Woman, Vote for Me, Why We Need Identity Politics," with a defense of identity politics. You call it the best tool in the fight for equality, but a lot of people have been critical of that approach for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, my argument really, and this is where I'd love to see this conversation go, is I think the way that identity politics is understood right now, and that was really a play off of Bernie Sanders. He had said, "I'm a woman, vote for me," and that's not enough. And I concede that his point is actually right, that it is not enough to just have, you know, kind of cosmetic references to diverse identities, right? Being a woman candidate isn't enough. We also need to hold you accountable, and we want someone who kind of represents our progressive values. That said, I think it's a very dangerous, slippery slope to suggest that on the left or as progressives, we have to move away from identity because that should actually be the core and root of what we do on the left, is centralizing those that are the most disenfranchised. And, you know, rather than looking at, oh, do we have enough diversity here, the focus should really be, what does welfare reform look like if you look at how it impacts different people based on their identity? What does it look like to talk about criminal justice reform if you talk specifically about how, say, Indigenous women are disproportionately impacted as opposed to white women? And so I think that really was the argument that I was making, is that there's a misconception right now about what identity politics means and the way that it should be incorporated in public, you know, in policy and in politics. And so we do ourselves a disservice by assuming that there's kind of a general American experience. We actually all experience citizenship differently, as, and I think Puerto Rico probably is the best example of that right now.
And Kyle, you wanted to jump in on that.
Yeah, I'll just add, and I think Smita talks about this as well in her essay, that Donald Trump also won on identity politics.
Yes.
I mean, he garnered a bunch of support from people who felt like they weren't being heard, and that was, in essence, an identity politic.
Yeah. And Bernie Sanders has said that Clinton's campaign didn't speak to economic anxieties in the electorate. That's something that Donald Trump did address. Do you think that the facts support that claim?
I think he addressed it on the campaign trail. What he's actually done in practice has been something very different. And this is kind of the subject of my piece in this book and of a lot of the reporting that I've been doing since the election. So, you know, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump went to Indiana. He went to the Carrier plant and promised that this plant is not going to close down. And this became this sort of icon of like Trump catering to the white working class. That plant, before the layoffs that have still come there, despite Trump's big mission accomplished moment, was 50% women. It was slightly more than half actually non-white workers. And the president of the union now, after Chuck Jones, the one who Trump famously got in a Twitter fight with, is now a black man. So when he went to this place and we sort of discussed this as a thing that was for, you know, this mythical white male worker, we're even still missing that part of the story of who those workers actually are.
My guests are Sarah Jaffe and Collier Morrison, among the contributors to a new book that has been edited by Samhita Mukhopadhyay and Kate Harding, called Nasty Women. Some of the other contributors are Cheryl Strayed, Rebecca Solnick, Katha Pollitt. And the book is published by Picador. Samhita, you note that it can be difficult to stay focused on a common goal when including the cause of so many different communities is attempted. Why should activists from feminist to Black Lives Matter to trans rights work towards a comprehensive, inclusive agenda? And is that possible?
I do think it's possible. I don't think it's necessary for every single issue that we work on, right? I think that right now we are seeing broadly this kind of loose resistance coming together, right, where people are working across issues and they are working in solidarity with each other. That said, there's, you know, there is a lot of differences in kind of philosophical views and even in kind of theories of change on the left. And I don't always think we need to see eye to eye on that. I think that we need to be really targeted on the policy issues that we work on and the ways that we work in coalition in those specific places. So, you know, I think the Muslim ban is a really good example of that, where several different groups, immigrant rights groups, you know, immigrant rights groups to, you know, people that advocate for the Muslim community all came together along with kind of labor groups as well. And so, you know, you have these like strategic, you have these moments where I think you can work in coalition. But yeah, I think it's lofty to suggest that all of us can kind of all of a sudden we're going to see eye to eye and work together. I just think we need to be doing it when it's possible.
And not seeing eye to eye reminds me, Collier, that in your essay, Pulling the Wool Over Their Eyes, The Blindness of White Feminists, you reveal that you didn't attend the women's marches.
Yeah. It was a game day decision. I wasn't sure. I struggled a lot that in the days coming up to the march. I wasn't covering it for any outlet, and so it would be a personal decision.
But you say that it looked like a celebration and also like boilerplate and mainstream feminism.
Right. So I was sitting at a friend's house, and we could see the march from her apartment, and it was a sea of pink hats and pink outfits and
Those are the pussy hats,
yeah. And folks were congratulating each other on Instagram about showing up and, you know, saying all sorts of obscenities about Donald Trump. And it felt to me, from being on the outside of it, that it was this sort of celebratory march.
What would have made it more acceptable to you?
Well, I'm not necessarily critical. I mean, I suppose I am critical of what has come afterwards. But I think that behind the pussy hats, there needs to be a way more concentrated and substantive feminism that goes beyond just wearing a hat. And I felt that day was sort of obscured, feminism was obscured.
Sarah, a listener on Twitter asks, do the guests believe if Secretary Clinton had embodied the ideas of Senator Sanders that she might not have lost?
Embodied is a really interesting word choice there, and I'm just going to leave that one there. I think that Hillary Clinton is a person that has a long history, and that even if she had shifted, and she did shift over the course of the campaign, we should say, even if she had shifted more, she was going to be weighed down by a lot of things. And since the word choice was embodied, one of those things is still being a woman. That said, I think that she did a bad job on a few very specific issues. And as you brought up earlier, Trump was able to sweep in and lie, but to pick off some voters that should have normally would have been Democratic voters.
On the other hand, many people have told me that they have rarely voted for a candidate. They usually vote against the candidate.
Yeah. I find that people like to vote for. And when I was working on my other book, one of the things that I studied was that the way that, like, the recall campaign against Scott Walker in 2011 sort of failed because there wasn't a very good candidate to run against him, that it turned out, you know, people will sort of stay home if they're not motivated to come out.
Yeah, and 94, like you said in the intro, 94% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton. But I think that there was this, there wasn't a lot of energy behind her in the same way that there could have been, precisely because it seemed like she was caving to the left as opposed to embracing the left.
Well, you covered the Black Lives Movement for 3 years as a journalist. In what ways were was the women's marches different?
Yeah, I think that you've sort of hit the nail on the head with that question. I think there was a lot of tension for people of color, for women of color specifically, and also for activists of color who had been out in the streets for 3 years beforehand, marching after death after death after indiscriminate deaths of Black men by police. And there was this sort of disconnect between that organizing and what happened at the Women's March.
You also refer to something that bell hooks has called lifestyle feminism. What's that?
I think that's essentially, she was trying to say the same thing that I just referred to, is that you can sort of call yourself a feminist, you can wear a nasty woman t-shirt, but there needs to be substance behind your feminism, and if not, then you are a lifestyle feminist.
We're going to take a little break and come back with more from my guests, Kalia Morrison, Sarah Jaffe, Samhita Mukhopadhyay, who is a co-editor with Kate Harding of a collection of essays that were written by a number of people, including my guests. It's called Nasty Women and subtitled Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. It's published by Picador. Stay with us for more. We are back with Samhita Mukhopadhyay, who is co-editor with Kate Harding of a new collection of essays that features a large group of writers: Cheryl Strayed, Rebecca Solnit, Jessica Valenti, Alicia Garza, Katha Pollitt, Samantha Irby, and Nicole Chung, and my other two guests here, Sarah Jaffe and Collier Meyerson. The book is called Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. It's published by Picador. Collier, you quoted one of the organizers in the march, Tamika Mallory, who said, we want people to have difficult, challenging, and courageous conversations with one another. Now, I'm throwing this out to all of you. What do you think those conversations should be about?
Well, something I think that has happened since the Women's March, just to talk about that because that was what my piece was about, is that there's been this incredible tension around intersectional feminism. That is a concept that was created by Kimberly Crenshaw, a professor at UCLA, which means that race, class, gender, identity are all informing each other. And since the Women's March and since Donald Trump has been elected president, I think that there has been an increase of tension between all of these groups who are working together. And so I think that Tamika is trying to, is insisting that these conversations need to be had urgently. And some of those, just to name one, there was a sort of stream of op-eds in the New York Times about that were targeting Linda Sarsour, who is a Muslim American, Palestinian American activist who also organized the Women's March. And it was, there were some of the attacks launched against her were, you know, she's not inclusive enough because she's coming from a place that's critical of Israel. And I don't feel, as a liberal Zionist, this is, I'm speaking for the woman who wrote this, Emily Shire, that I don't feel like this is also my feminism. And so there are these tensions between feminists, between Linda Sarsour, between Emily Shire. And I think that Tamika is sort of speaking to the need to address those tensions.
Yeah I wrote
By the way, should feminism be all inclusive? I mean,
no.
Shouldn't we expect it?
I think that the amazing thing about intersectional feminism is also that it's a headache, right?
So
yes. It's like there are all of these people under this giant tent, and you know, I might disagree with Sarah on something. I actually don't think I do, but if I did,
I'll find something.
it's an intellectual pursuit, and also you know,
a political struggle, right?
And so these sorts of conversations need to be had.
Yeah, I want to throw this to Samhita in a second, but I also wanted to say, like, I wrote in my piece about the women's strike, which came a few months later on International Women's Day and was called by an international group of women that included things like the abortion rights struggle in Ireland, and in the U.S. became sort of connected to this, the post-Women's March anti-Trump resistance. And there was a lot of debate around that, about whether it was quote-unquote privileged to go on strike. And I was saying, you know, we have to look at the women who've been going on strike already in this country for months and years now over their very particular labor rights. And these are working class women like Venancy Luna, who is a Walmart worker, one of the first Walmart workers to go on strike in 2012. And these people are not striking because they're privileged. They're striking because they have no privileges and they have to actually strike to make their situation better.
And you wrote that on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton refused to endorse a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Yeah.
To what extent did that affect her relationship with working class voters, considering the fact that Donald Trump also didn't support a $15 an hour minimum wage?
And I think Donald Trump didn't get the votes from the kind of working people who would have needed a $15 an hour minimum wage. If you look at the income breakdown, Hillary Clinton won the lowest income people. What Donald Trump really appealed to successfully was sort of people that we would have thought of as middle class, right? The kind of again, the factory workers at a place like Carrier who are right that their standard of living is slipping. They are not the poorest. What they have is what Barbara Ehrenreich famously called sort of the fear of falling.
Mm-hmm. And the fear of it being taken away from immigrants.
Right, by the people below you, right?
But more than 50% of those who supported Donald Trump and I believe voted for him made more than $75,000.
Right. Economic anxiety doesn't have to be literally like you are the poorest person in the world. I have economic anxiety and I make above the national, you know, median wage and I still worry about paying my bills.
But Kalia, you wrote that 94% of black women who voted for Hillary Clinton are paying for 53% of white women's failure for empathy. Do you think that a failure of empathy for the loss for the lives of black women ultimately led them to vote for Trump?
I mean, look, I think that there is a crisis in this country when it comes, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates recently wrote in a piece that that race is at the center of political life in America.
And you think I would that's just true?
Echo, yeah, I would echo that, that, yeah, I do believe that.
Well, what about all the people who, white people who would say, well, that's not the the big issue for me?
I guess, you know.
Is this like men who claim to be feminists who are, when women say, well, you can't be a feminist if you're a man?
Yeah, no. I guess I would say, like, pick up a couple books, like, reflect, meditate, you know?
Yeah, I mean, just to jump in here, I would say that, you know, not only is it a lack of empathy, but it's also like it may not have been, you know, what motivated people to vote for Trump alone, right? Like, we know that there's a handful of people, perhaps a minority of people, that were really inspired by the racist rhetoric, but but for the rest of them, it was really just like, oh, whatever, not a deal breaker, you know? Right, and to me, that is a lack of empathy, right? That is a lack of empathy, because it's just saying that, like, you'll turn an eye, you know, you'll turn a blind eye, even though this person is perpetuating really toxic myths about people of color.
I'm speaking with Samhita Mukhopadhyay, who is co-editor with Kate Harding of a book called Nasty Women: Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. It's published by Picador. Also with us are two of the contributors to the book, Sarah Jaffe and Kalia Myerson. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sarah, how did the workers of the Fight for 15 movement help bring down Andrew Pudster, the fast food chain CEO who withdrew his nomination as President Trump's labor secretary in February?
He was very tired of the abuse, was the quote from his friend that I love so much.
The owner of Hardee's and
the
Carl's
owner
Jr.
of one of the fast, and I don't remember the numbers, I don't have the page in the book open in front of me, that had, and fast food and low wage service work in general have incredibly high rates of sexual harassment, right?
I could give you the figures.
Okay,
I've
there you
them
go.
Down.
Yes.
You said sexual harassment rates 1.5 times higher than the already high 40% harassment rates in fast food industry as a whole.
Yes. So Andy Pudster famously sort of defended the very sexist ads that Hardee's ran. Workers who worked at Hardee's said things like people will ask them why they don't dress like the women in the ads. And so the Fight for 15, already sort of well-organized to challenge whoever Trump was going to nominate for the Labor Department, is a movement of largely of fast food workers. And so when they, when Trump nominated a fast food CEO, which seemed really kind of like a screw you to that movement in general, these people who, again, are majority women of color in this movement were like, oh, hell no. And they went on strike again. They marched. They demanded. They made phone calls. They organized other people to make phone calls. And they really made this guy's life miserable enough that he withdrew his nomination.
And you write, in Wisconsin, where labor battles have been central, Hillary Clinton's inattention amounted to campaign malpractice. And often Republicans say, well, you know, I didn't tell her not to go to Wisconsin. I didn't tell her not to go to Michigan.
The Wisconsin, I mentioned Scott Walker earlier, right? A state where Scott Walker has been elected not once, not twice, but three times. Assuming that that was safe for any Democrat, not just Hillary Clinton, any Democrat. If Bernie Sanders had been the nominee and had not gone to Wisconsin, I would be saying the same thing about him. What the heck were you doing?
Why should progressive movements prioritize the demands of service sector workers? You write about a woman named Varanasi Luna.
Yeah. So service sector workers are at the intersections, as we're talking about intersectional feminism, of all of these different demands, right? They are facing sexual harassment in the workplace at ludicrous numbers. They are mostly Black and brown women. Many of them are immigrant women. They face all sorts of challenges in the home because they don't get paid enough to pay for childcare, right? They are in the middle of so many of the demands that we need to make right now. And if we listen to them, we would actually solve a lot of these problems at once, rather than, you know, solving them sort of, we're going to worry about abortion access over here, and we're going to worry about paid sick days over mm-hmm. here, and we're going to worry about a $15 minimum wage, and we're going to worry about sexual harassment over here.
You're nodding your head, Kyle.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, for those feminists who woke up, I mean, I read Cheryl Strayed's piece, and I have immense respect for her and her writing and her perspective as well. And I think that she echoes a lot of white women who sort of woke up. In her piece, she says something along the lines of, I thought that things were getting better. I didn't realize that things were so bad. And I think that what Sarah's speaking to could really be a rallying, could be the focal point of a sort of rallying cry for those women and for all women who have just woken up for kind of the first time. And I think that that also is a bit of a tension between women of color, especially immigrant women who have been on the front lines of these issues for so long, and they've been saying, like, where have you been, middle-class white feminists? And I think now this election really served as a moment for where a lot of middle-class white women woke up and said, whoa, I had no idea. And I think that this is a sort of, like, perfect storm for feminism to really thrive. But, you know, I'm trying not to be so cynical these days. So,
well, Sarah and Collier, you both acknowledge in your essays that direct action and what some people have called the resistance involves risk taken by the protesters at Standing Rock and activists in the Black Lives Movement in Ferguson. Do you think this idea is widely accepted by liberals and people who think of themselves as progressive?
Yeah, I actually do. I actually think that the idea, I just wrote a piece on Black people, Black voters in Ohio, and a large swath of them in Central Ohio didn't know the term resistance, didn't identify with it, had never heard of it. These are working class people. And so I actually think that the resistance movement is a sort of bourgeois.
Well, what was the civil rights movement? Wasn't it a resistance movement?
Yes, of course. But I'm just talking specifically about this term.
The sort of hashtag resistance has become a thing that has a sort of nebulous identity beyond just the use of the word as an adjective. Right.
Should working class concerns also be a key part of intersectional feminism?
I think they are.
Yeah, I think that's one of the peak things. Yeah.
Well, how can feminism incorporate the causes of workers like Varanasi Luna and others like her?
Well, if you see some of the, like, main organizing, and I'm sorry.
No, jump in.
Jumping in from Tacoma, actually.
Please.
but I actually, if you see some of the most exciting organizing that's happening, grassroots organizing, it's groups like the National Domestic Workers Alliance or even Black Lives Matter, which is led by, you know, and founded by three queer Black women who are kind of at the forefront of organizing on these issues and have found a way to actually incorporate all these different intersectional issues. And they may not prioritize them every step of the way as they do the organizing. But if you look at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, they focus on domestic workers, which are predominantly Black and brown women, many of them undocumented. And they work on a variety of issues, and they're extremely strategic, from state level legislation to minimum wage organizing to other types of other types of quality of work environment and things like that. And they've been very intentional about being intersectional in their organizing. So it's actually possible. And I think one of the things, just as feminists, and I would love to see us moving away from, is focus less on, I am a feminist, you know, and that means this, this, and this, and really focus on how we apply these intersectional values and our feminism to the organizing.
Yeah, wear your nasty women shirt at a rally.
Wear it to the picket line.
Yeah, wear it to the picket line, to, you know, your community board meeting. You know, be in the trenches. Yeah.
Why do you think that the Access Hollywood thing, more recently, just today, defunding of birth control, hasn't had more of an impact on women who are supporting this administration?
You know, I just finished writing a piece about women who voted for Trump, and there's a really interesting interview in Cosmopolitan, actually, with Kellyanne Conway, who's Trump's advisor, right? And she was talking very openly about all the sexual harassment she faced coming up in her career, and her response to it is kind of like, if I made a big deal out of it, I'd be in trouble. And yesterday we heard the news that Harvey Weinstein, who is a big Democratic donor, donated a whole bunch of money to Hillary Clinton, has a long history of really abusive sexual harassment, and you do get used to it, and you have to deal with it. And like, what I look at on this front especially, because generationally, right, the youngest women voted for Hillary Clinton, and Trump's vote percentage of women went up as the age went up. And I look at that and I say, the people who are used to dealing with that just said, shrug, that is how most men talk. And for a lot of their life, that may have been true. And younger women put up with less. Women who are 10 years younger than me put up with a lot less than I do. And I think it's great, personally.
Well, we will continue this conversation in the future. But my great thanks to the three of you for coming by to talk about it today.
Thank you.
Samhita Mukhopadhyay is a co-editor with Kate Harding of a collection of essays called Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. It's published by Picador. Two of the contributors to the book, Sarah Jaffe and Kalia Meyerson, have also been here. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.